In traditional concepts of civilization, we tend not to think of the frozen tundra and ice of the Arctic North, or the endless grassland steppes of Eurasia, as the homelands of great civilizations. But with a more generous idea of civilizations, we will discover the remarkable story of the Sami, the Nyenyets, and the Lapps of the North and the ice, and the Scythians of the Eurasian steppe. Welcome to the Burning Archives, Summer of Civilizations. I am Jeff Rich. This is the Burning Archive podcast, where I help you see the world more clearly with some quality world history. And there are all sorts of reasons in 2024 to want to explore all of world history's civilizations. And I am going to guide you on that journey through this special summer season of the podcast of 12 or a few more episodes. I'm coming up to 3 years of this podcast, and I thought this summer there were some really good reasons to return to the theme of the many diverse civilizations of what some people call the multipolar world. We've seen a lot of talk in recent years about the fate of Western civilization hanging in the balance. We've seen the leader of China, Xi Jinping, announcing a global civilizations initiative. We've seen Russia declare itself a civilization state in its foreign policy, and India celebrate the civilizational achievements of Bharat. We've also heard many tropes, good and bad, of civilization as opposed to barbarism or something else. And there is also just a lot of curiosity about what is a multipolar world really like? What does it really mean to live in a world where there's more equal relationships and more equanimity between not just the powers of Western civilization, but all the other civilizations of the world as well? So I'm reaching back to some earlier podcasts I did in 2022 that look at the history of civilizations. One of the problems with looking at the history of civilizations is so much has been written about them. But fortunately, I knew of a guide in the form of one great history book, written by the historian Felipe Fernandez Amesto, who I had the pleasure and the privilege to interview late last year on the podcast. One book, Civilizations, that can offer you a creative, accessible, imaginative, and in many ways quite delightful, generous world tour of the history of the world's civilizations. His book, Civilizations, has that theme, and it's very important that he expresses it in the plural. There are more than one way to skin a cat, and there is more than one way to lead a civilized life. And if you'd like to explore the history of civilizations more, and also to go on the journey through the history of the world's civilizations, that enormous journey in an achievable, simple, compressed form by reading through a single book with me and discussing it more, I'm going to be offering a very special program starting in February, where I take you through the ideas, the concepts, and the history of the civilization, the history of civilization as articulated for through Felipe Fernandez Ernesto's book, and I'll give you a little bit more information about that new special program, but you can join up now. It's going to be starting in February, but you can sign up now or join a mailing list by going to courses, C-O-U-R-S-E-S, dot Jeff Rich Writer, all one word, JeffRichWriter.com. And I'll add a little bit more details about that now. But why don't you sit back and relax, maybe enter that URL into your website now, and listen to the remarkable stories of the tamers of reindeer, the peoples of the frozen north, the remarkable book written by a Christian archbishop about them, The Shaman's Drums, and the way in which Western civilization set out to destroy them, and the incredible story of the steppe, the origins of the myth of Gog and Magog, the highway of civilizations, the Scythians, and what it has to do with ideas of Eurasia in a multipolar world. First of all, let's talk about deserts, tundras, and ice. And Felipe Fernandez Ernesto begins his book in Civilizations with what would seem to be the ultimate contrast to the fertile crescent of, that's the cradle of civilization, and that is the wastelands of deserts, tundra, and ice. And in these sections, he talks about the Ice Age in Europe, Northern Scandinavia, Asiatic tundra, I guess that vast region across the top of Eurasia, which is largely Russia, Arctic America, and Greenland under ice. And in deserts of sand, he talks about the North American Southwest, Northern Peru, the Sahara, the Gobi, and the Kalahari. And the little section I'm going to focus on as an example of how to twist our ideas about civil, or to turn our ideas around civilization and how their adaptations to the environment on its head a little bit, is the section about the Sami people and the Lapps, or the people of the north, the tamers of reindeer, is the section that I'm going to talk about. He begins this little chapter by saying deserts of ice have a bad reputation as homes of civilization. They would seem to be incredibly difficult environments. And yet that is also what has clearly happened. Many great civilizations have found a way to adapt that environment. So there have been cultures that have emerged and successfully prospered and found ways of adapting this harsh, harsh environment to human needs. And similarly, more blessed or cultures with more blessed environments have tended to see the peoples of the north as barbarians. And there is a long, long tradition of that kind of both noble savagery and also subhuman barbarity projected onto the people of the north, the Sami of northern Scandinavia, and so on. But Fernandez Ernesto really makes the point that to adapt the old world, like pre-industrial Arctic environment, to human needs is a truly remarkably ambitious attempt to control extraordinary seasonal fluctuations and to find ways to exploit relationships with the weather and also with the wild beasts. And in particular, one of the most remarkable things was the development of a reindeer herding culture amongst the Sami of northern Scandinavia and the Ninjets, who sort of in on the edge of the Arctic Ocean between, I guess, top of Russia, top of Siberia, and also some other Siberian peoples, the Yemen, Koryak, and the Chukchi. What these peoples evolved was a kind of controlled nomadism, which used the resource of the reindeers with extraordinary imagination and versatility. They combined hunting in the wild, taming selected individual beasts, and regulating the migration of huge herds, and practices developed over centuries. There are clear written accounts of these practices dating back to the 9th century AD, and a particularly remarkable account by a man named Olaus Magnus, who was the Archbishop of Uppsala, and he wrote an incredible book called The Description of the Northern Peoples in the 1500s, based on his own travels in those times. We'll come back to that in a second. These people developed a structured rhythm of herding life, where the herds were moved from breeding grounds in the summer to places where there's a cull to collect the meat, and moving on to winter quarters. And there have been herds of thousands of reindeer controlled by two or three herdsmen with the help of dogs. Reindeer were totally vital to the life and the culture of these groups, the Nyingyet, the Sami, etc. And in Nyingyet, the sort of northern Russian, Siberian type Arctic group, reindeer, the term for reindeer, zhileb, actually means life. And it's reflected in the huge range of uses of the reindeer. They're used for food, for skins, drink, blood and marrow. Their horns are used in many different ways. The bone is used for arrowheads and needles. Their guts are used to make thongs and thread. And, of course, their coat is used for a very warm coat. And, of course, reindeer meat is used widely. It was pointed out by Olaus Magnus back in the 1500s that to survive, to adapt a culture to this environment required exceptional technical resourcefulness. He wrote, "As the nations of a hot or temperate zone are clearly free from frost, cold, snow, rime, ice and howling winter storms, they can hardly grasp the diversity of skills, facilities and appliances with which those who live in the bitter cold of the north defend themselves and make arrangements to deal with the severities of this kind. For if nature herself has fortified wild creatures with many wonderful limbs and joints to make them complete, what should she not grant for his comfort to the feebleness of man?" So amongst these technological achievements are skis and arrows and crossbows, spears, tents. The use of reindeer is locomotion, sleds, lassos, snowshoes, dams for trapping fish, fox traps, and many other paraphernalia of Arctic life. And in addition, there was a tradition of, a speculated tradition perhaps, of magic and shamanism amongst these people. It was said that they exchanged weapons for wizardry and made war by invoking rain. But perhaps Fernandez Amesto says these are really what appear to be divination and augury, are really the skills of people closely attuned to nature and practiced in reading her ways, predicting weather, foreseeing glut and dearth, tracking beasts and armies, and finding their way by watching bird flight. Those whom civilized life has separated from nature see these skills as marvelous. But the shamanism also carried a great tradition, which was the drum, the shaman's drum, which was used to harness the power of the sort of night journey dream travels of the shamans and to summon the dead in the service of the living. But these drums, which were, if you like, the cultural artifact of the rich culture and the rich civilization of this group of people, at least amongst the Sami, were largely destroyed in a wave of Christian evangelism in the 16th, 17th and 18th century. They were destroyed in really a great act of cultural destruction. And even though they were lost, Fernandez Mesto says, the art of reading their pictographic, so these drums were illustrated with various images, and there's only a few of these magic drums that survived the wave of Christian sort of cultural destruction. And they were decorated with pictographic inscriptions, which represented a form of written culture, let's say. The art of reading their pictographic inscriptions has been lost, but should not be taken to mean that the red figures traced in older bark juice on the reindeer hide drum skins did not once recall stories or spells for their shamanic interpreters, or according to plausible modern attempts at decipherment, display cosmic diagrams or maps of the heavens. So that is the story of a civilization in the deserts of ice, the Sami of the north. And there are some great television shows now describing the life of the Sami. But again, there is also those artifacts of compassion and understanding, like Olaus Magnus's description of the northern peoples, which Fernandez Amesto describes as one of the world's great unacknowledged works of genius, a generous and open-minded act of wonder and appreciation of the culture of the northern people, still so strange and different to that of a Christian bishop in Sweden, but one that has survived to tell those stories, and also the remarkable drums of the shamans, of the Sami bear hunters, so many of which are lost, but which also give us a brief, short glimpse into a rich culture and civilization of the ice. Okay, so number two is about the grasslands and the Eurasian steppe. Here, Fernandez Amesto talks about the uncultivable grasslands and the Eurasian steppe. And I spoke a little bit about the Eurasian steppe in the previous episode. The great grasslands of the world include the Eurasian steppe, all the way from Manchuria to the western shore of the Black Sea, the great North American plain between the Rocky Mountains and the Mississippi Valley and the Great Lakes, and the North African savanna and Sahel, which is that sort of strip up the top of it above the Sahara Desert. And these environments have been full of grass, I guess. And some of those grasses, like wheat and rye, have been converted into the traditional cultivable plants of civilizations, cradles of civilizations. But on the whole, the grasses, the native grasses of these grasslands, are not so great for human food, but what they have attracted are the big, like the bison and the other, the horses and other kind of grazing animals that have been hunted and herded by the peoples of these areas. And these grasslands are not without variety, of course. There is great diversity in little microclimates and little ecological niches and whatnot within the vast land. It's not the endless steppe of cliché. Particularly so, perhaps, in Africa. But it is to the great Eurasian steppe that I'm going to turn for my little example of a civilization based in this kind of this kind of environment. And the Eurasian steppe, Fernandez Ernesto introduces as the Wastes of Gog. Gog and Romance, Gog and Magog being the, I think, Greek story, in the Greek story, the guards of the ends of the world. They sort of guarded the gates of Europe, so to speak, in the Carpathian Mountains. Gog and Magog, I think, are shown in one of the arcades in Collins Street, Melbourne. But according to the story, they were guarding the entry to the great Pontic Caspian steppe that stretched from Hungary through to Central Asia and in on to Manchuria. And this steppe has attracted much cultural commentary, especially, like, I guess, in Russian culture, because really Russia straddles the steppe and the taiga. Or in the Russian world, especially if one includes the various former Soviet republics as well, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, etc., etc., Soviet republics or Russian imperial provinces. It can be a landscape of wind and apparent endless open sky, and it's evoked all sorts of descriptions as such. So, for example, there was a German traveller in the 19th century, J.G. Cole, who described the steppe as a land of movement, whose law is movement, whose soil abhors deep-rooted plants, favouring instead mobile cattle breeding, whose winds carry everything before them far and wide, and whose flatness invites everything to cross it in haste. This is the terrain that Barry Cunliffe, the archaeologist, describes as the greatest natural corridor on earth, and that Felipe Fernandez Ernesto describes as the highway of civilizations. So much has traveled over here, and the much debated territory of Ukraine is indeed on the great Eurasian steppe, the Pontic Caspian steppe. And, you know, there are many descriptions from previous times of peoples who have lived and adapted and travelled across Ukraine and the broader Eurasian steppe. Of course, famously, the steppe I think I might have mentioned in the previous episode was the home of nomadic cavalry and the birth of horse riding and indeed the domestication of the horse, so fundamental to them. But there were also forms of quite sophisticated cultures that developed, sophisticated and artistically wondrous cultures that developed, including those known by ancient Greek writers as the Scythians or Scythians and the Sarmatians. S-C-Y-T-H-I-A-N-S, and the Sarmatians, S-A-M-A-R-T-I-A-N-S. Fernandez Ernesto says that the demanding environment of the steppe, you know, its winds, its flatness, its sun, its shifts of hot and cold, perhaps because of the demanding environment and the competitive, violent way of life, this was also a region of impressive and precocious technical developments. And hence we have the domestication of horses, the development of covered wagons, the horse riding, the stirrup, the cavalry, but we also have remarkable and beautiful ironwork and jewel work and gold work, particularly by the Scythians or Scythians, and the Scythians were horse riders. They were famous fighters, but they also were in regular trade with the Greek craftsmen, and many of them were based around the Sea of Azov and the north part of the Black Sea, where there is, currently fighting going on between Russia and Ukraine. This is in the era of second half of the first millennium BC, so for say 500 BC through to those sites around the north of the Black Sea have found really quite significant and impressive and quite beautiful gold objects. I guess, what would you call them? Plaques and plates and jewelry. Quite exquisite representations of humans and horses and trees and whatnot. Really quite beautiful if you kind of check them out. And it was, although some of those findings have been in southern Ukraine, and although times Ukraine has claimed, I guess, the Scythians as their own, it's generally thought that the home base, so to speak, of the Scythians was really southern Siberia, and that they extended out from around about 900 BC to 200 BC all the way westward across Central Asia into the northern Black Sea. And in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, you can go and actually visit look at some of the extraordinary artwork that is that has survived around the Scythians. I might also just add as a bit of a side that there was a whole movement in early 20th century Russian culture called Scythianism, which really espoused a Russian identity that was Eurasian rather than European, and, invoked the memory of the Scythian culture as a Eurasian culture based across the Great Steppe and the Taiga, and represented a alternative future for Russia other than a future in Europe. And in an interesting sort of way, I guess, Russia over the last, 30 years has been going through a similar kind of process of wanting to join Europe and the Atlantic world, finding itself spurred, and then choosing to find its future in Eurasia as a kind of a multi-ethnic state in a multipolar world. Anyhow, so the Scythians are a very significant and important culture of the steppe. And I hope you can see by that example how the idea of civilizations is still relevant to the world today. It is being used in the world today, and looking at civilizations in a plural and neutral way, an objective way, as Felipe Fernandez-Amesta does, appreciating the achievements of many civilizations in many different parts of the world, helps us understand that the world today is multipolar, but the world has always been multipolar, and there has always been processes of globalization, trading and transmitting culture and biota and peoples, institutions, languages across the Eurasian steppe, across the frozen north, across all the continents of the world. Globalization didn't begin in 1990. It perhaps began when we first moved out of Africa. If you're interested in those ideas, why don't you subscribe to my Substack at jeffrich.substack.com, where I write regularly about history, and I'm doing a special series for my top supporters on the tides of globalization. And you can also check out my course, World History Explorers. Season 1 is starting on the 1st of March. You can join now at courses.jeffrichwriter.com. I'm going to explore in that course Felipe Fernandez Amesto's book, Civilizations. Go into a little bit more depth into the material I've discussed in this podcast. We'll focus on simplifying a way into the best quality world history for people who are curious, whether you're curious about geopolitics or you're curious about traveling the world or you're just curious about connecting the dots between all the things that you've learnt about the incredibly amazing diverse world that we live in and how it's changing, then this will be a great program for you, and I think it will help take you through to a deeper insight to help see the world more clearly, more compassionately, and I think more creatively, with the benefit of some really quality world history, and I think have a bit of fun and a bit of a laugh and a bit of companionship along the way. Now, do join me next week where I will be looking at tropical lowlands, and our world tour of world history will take us to Australia's near neighbour, Papua New Guinea, one of the earliest places in the world to develop agriculture, and to Africa and the remarkable city, the walled city of Benin. Do join me then, and until then, do remember, what thou lovest well will not be reft from thee.